chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now, welcome to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, all of us in Chapel Hill and all of us in North Carolina, all of us across the country are worried about education, and not just higher education at the university level, but our whole K through 12 experience, and whether our country's fallen behind or whether it's leaping ahead with lots of new initiatives. One of the guys I used to be able to talk to about this when I was on the staff of the General Administration of the University of North Carolina, and he was either the Dean of the School of Education at East Carolina or Vice President of the UNC system, is Charles Coble. Charlie, what a background in education you got, and now you're working with school systems all across the country to help deal with challenges that they face and working on improvement plans and thinking of things that maybe others haven't thought about. So I'll ask Jen to come share with me just you're thinking about, what you're worried about. What'd you do this past week? What you working on this past week?
Well, this past week was an interesting week. As you alluded to, I've had the opportunity since leaving the UNC General Administration, where you and I had the opportunity for you to teach me, actually, how to work with General Assemblies and work in the higher echelons of decision-making in our state, which was a real blessing to me.
If I taught you how to do that, would you teach me back?
Well, there's a lot we need to continue to learn, apparently. But, so this issue you just laid out, what's going on with the development of public education in this country, and where does higher education play a role in that, and what is its continuing responsibility, is absolutely on the front burner of this nation's agenda right now. And I think so because we now know even more deeply that which we knew a long time ago, and that is education is actually also an economic development imperative for the country. We've always known it had a democratizing function about it, and we applaud that. That's why we have a universal public education system in this nation and prepare teachers for that system. But it's become crystal clear that as we grew up in North Carolina and we knew the labor of our backs was the road to economic success for most citizens in our state, really, and higher education was for the limited few, and teachers in our communities.
Most people were going to work physically in some fashion or another,
right.
Based on higher education or a higher degree
that's
of learning.
That's right. And it was and still is honorable work. However, the difference between now and then is that growing up in the Piedmont section of the state and living in a community that was textile-oriented and farming, it was very clear that people could, in fact, move into those that work, make a good living, perhaps only have one breadwinner in the family and raise your children, have a home, have a car, and have a good life. In fact, growing up in my little community of Oakboro, we had never talked about dropouts, even though half the students who began the first grade with me were not there on graduation day. They went to work, and they didn't drop out. They went to work. In fact, good work, and we're doing quite well. Nevertheless, over time, we've seen all of that virtually disappear. And so the labor of our backs cannot produce the economic wealth for our families and for our communities and for our nation as once it did. So we have to recognize the shift that's gone on, which is that—
Charles, to interrupt that thought, I mean, all that makes a great deal of sense. On the other hand, it's not that those jobs aren't available because we're importing people to do— there are those jobs available.
Right.
We're just—
Right.
We're unwilling to do them? I mean, aren't those jobs— – some of those jobs are still available?
Absolutely. And they will always be— – in fact, that's one of the fastest growing sectors of employment in our nation are those low-level jobs. However, in the past, those were jobs that we could maintain ourselves in a lifestyle to which
we— – So they're there. They just don't pay enough to build a good living on.
That's right. And I think now most people view themselves— – as passing through through that work on the way to a different life. And so nevertheless, that work will still continue. Now, there is a question that maybe perhaps we can get into about a living wage.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I got you right, off track. But right, but those – going back to Oakboro, right, and your contemporaries who could make move from school to job and then work the rest of their life in that job, right, and have a reasonably good living, I can't do that anymore.
Very difficult. I mean, nowhere near the lifestyle to which the majority of citizens in a middle-class America would want to live. And so where has that economic possibility shifted to? It's shifted to what goes on between our ears and what we're able to have flow from that. And so education has moved to a much higher level of interest, concern, and need for people to advance their own economic well-being as well as the economic well-being of the state and the nation. And so I think that's the reason why people are very concerned, especially when we see our scores on critical areas like in science and technology and mathematics faring lower. In fact, in some cases, much lower than other nations around the world. And there's the inference that if that's the leading edge of information about what has to happen, if that's where we are internationally on these test scores, maybe that's an indication of where we're going to be economically, and no one aspires to that. Mm. So that's a hypothesis, and some people actually disagree with it, but it's more the prevailing opinion than not.
Well, what do you think in terms – I mean, we can get statistics to prove a lot of things that might not be exactly right. And but you've seen all of the statistics and all the statistical comparisons between the United States and other countries and between North Carolina and other states and other countries. And I've always wondered, is because we have this mandate for educating everybody, that it might be that if you selected out our high achievers and put them in contest with the higher achievers in other places, we'd be fine, that we're just trying to do a better job of uplifting folks who may not ever going to be high achievers. Or, I mean, is there any hope that the figures mislead us?
Okay. Or are they? Well, you know, I wish I could supply some relief here. However, I can only supply additional concern.
Keep going then.
And that is that just 15 years ago, and I'm being general here, I'm not exactly sure, but it's within that time frame, the United States graduated more people from high school, as low as our dropout, as low as our graduation rate is, by the way, which is only about 75% nationally.
Our graduation rate is 75% of those who start school in the first grade or the kindergarten?
Yes. And that's
in some respects compared to what I mean, that some people would argue we only have a 25% dropout rate all the way through compared. You know, you went back to Oakboro 50 years ago. Right. It would have been just the opposite.
That's right. No, it's actually gotten better, but we plateaued. We leveled out. Now, we were way ahead of the rest of the nations on Earth on that score. That is, they were, in fact, just educating the brightest and the best, and that's what we were being compared to, and it's an unfair comparison. A lot of people argued about that in the early days. But now what we see, the United States is the last figures I saw, we were ranked 14th in the world for high school completion. Now, we were first in the world, well into our maturity, okay, whenever that occurred. Mm-hmm. But we are not there anymore.
So we were first in the world 25, 30, 40, 50 years
ago.
In terms of the percentage of our first graders who graduated from high school. And while our rate has improved, the world's rate has improved
faster
than ours.
Faster. And so, in fact, in the world that we really sort of, in a sense, care about economically, the nations with whom we are in direct economic, if you will, competition, those nations have advanced very quickly. So at one time, the universal education commitment in the United States, which is still there and it's a fabulous commitment, we have leveled out and are not really improving that much in terms of high school completion rates while the rest of the world has moved forward. And so now we haven't declined so much. It's just we haven't moved ahead. We plateaued while they're continuing to work. So the rest of the world saw our model, saw it was a better model than just the, quote, brightest and best model, emulated what we did and trumped us.
Just before we take a break, and what you're telling me is that the rest of the world is now attempting – universal education in the same fashion that the United States has done it for a longer period of time.
You know, it's slightly different variations, and we can talk about that later. But the idea is, yes, high school completion, moving forward to complete a high school degree. Now, what that means in some nations actually is very different from the United States. That is, it might be more technically oriented. In most cases, it is at a higher level than our high school completion means. So a high school degree in many of our competing nations – now, we're not talking about many of the nations of the world. We're talking about the few, the OECD countries that – which we are in competition with. They are completing high school degrees at a much higher level in many cases than we are. So the high school degree means more going on.
In terms of how it affects a person's individual economic situation later on. Well, Charles Coble, we need to take a break. I'm visiting with my friend Charles Coble, a former Dean of Education at East Carolina University and Vice President of the UNC system. He and I'll be right back.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and my guest is Charles Coble. Dr. Coble is the former Dean of Education at East Carolina University and Vice President of the UNC system. Throughout his lifetime, he's been focused on education. Charles, let's put aside the problems that the country faces for just a moment and talk about some specific things that you're doing in terms of which might illustrate how different education systems are addressing the problems that come up. I mean, you're not dealing – I mean, in your work as a consultant, you're not dealing with all the problems.
No.
You're dealing with some specific ones that some specific schools or states or higher education systems face in dealing with specific challenges. I mean, I don't want you to tell us anything out of school that you – but can you – talk about some of these things, some of the challenges some of your clients are facing.
Absolutely. First of all, most of my work has been focused not actually on K-12 education, but on preparing teachers for K-12 education.
Indirectly at K-12, in getting people recruited, prepared, and ready to face the challenges of the classroom.
That's right. That's right.
Why is that such a big challenge?
Well, a fellow named Bill Saunders, who was in Tennessee, who we actually recruited and brought to North Carolina, came out with some startling research. He actually confirmed what everybody sort of knows, but he put the first data around it, and that is the effect that a teacher has on student achievement in the classroom. Now, that would seem self-evident to most citizens walking around, you know. And in fact, it wasn't confirmed, however. That is, what are the effects of a teacher?
Everybody assumes and every parent believes that their child's success is enhanced if their child has a teacher who understands what that child needs and works with them rather than a teacher who's disengaged and not focused on it. We know that, but we couldn't prove it until Dr. Saunders came along.
He nailed it.
And how did he do that? How did he nail it?
Well, his methodology is actually a trade secret.
So okay. Well, you could give us
– he's making money off that.
But I mean, you can give us the outline.
Sure, absolutely. He measured the effect. He went to the bottom line. He started measuring the effect of teachers on the impact they have on students. Now, first of all, you have to have a state in which there's actually measures of student achievement going on. And they have to stay with those measures long enough to be able to compare apples to apples, oranges to oranges. And so what he uncovered was that if you have a teacher year one, year two, year three, that can generally elevate the achievement of students in the classroom, which is the way he defines an effective teacher.
State test.
So the effective teachers, that he found that some teachers, no matter what setting they were in, seemed to have this positive effect on students. Now, what Bill didn't know and he still really doesn't know is why that happens. That's my interest, of why that happens. And that's why we're still in good communication about that question. He knows that some teachers have that effect and some teachers don't. And if
– I mean, it could be. The difficulty is just right. Like humans are different, that you could have 100 different ways in which teachers very effectively do their work. And it might be that if you try to impose teacher A's great method of helping students achieve on teacher B, whose method is not that you could wreck a good
Absolutely.
Teacher.
In fact, we have some evidence of that. In which people they have the, quote, right answer, and they try to impose that over the teachers, and in doing so have actually made some teachers less effective than they were before. So you're spot on to a critical point, and that is while there may be common patterns of impact on students, there may not necessarily be a common pattern of the teacher's role in achieving that end.
This is so interesting to me because you're responsible for training out ways to get teachers prepared either in their university training or their postgraduate learning and teaching experience. Right. And you got the challenge like a football coach.
Yeah.
And some football coaches come in and say everybody – or a basketball coach is easier for me
yeah.
– that I need every – I need for you to be able to – when you shoot on the other side of the basket, I need – everybody needs to shoot like this, and it just doesn't work for some player. Or you got a coach who very carefully looks at the strengths and the way that the particular player – and then adjust his method of playing to that player's strengths. God, it's so complicated.
That's exactly the point. And so we do have some bottom lines. In fact, the sports analogy I think is a good one. That is, you have to have the desire. You have to want to. You have to have high expectations. You have to go into a classroom prepared. Those things are for everybody. Now, the way that plays out is just like your basketball metaphor. The way you move, the way you shoot, the way you rebound, the way you guard – can be very unique, but the bottom line is you get the job done.
How do you measure those first things that you described about motivation and preparation?
Yes. The issue before the country right now is exactly that question. So we're moving from Saunders and now some other people who have all across this country using different methodologies have confirmed Bill's initial finding that, in fact, the teacher is actually the number one reason why a child achieves in school. The number one factor, by the way, in student achievement lies outside the school, and that's with the parents and the guardians. They can actually undermine the impact of a teacher in a school. So when you and I were growing up, we knew that whatever the teacher said was law. And if we had our problems at school, we were going to have probably another problem at home. We don't have that social compact right now. And in the countries that are outperforming us, that compact is still in place. And so we have a rebuilding job to do outside the school, and we have a job to do inside
the school. So the number – I mean, just to try to regurgitate what you told me, the number one – distinctive element which improves students' test scores or achievement levels is the teacher.
In-school factors, that's right.
I want to get this straight.
Yes.
The in-school factor, but all of that, you can have a great teacher, a well-prepared, well-motivated, potentially very effective teacher, and if the parents scuttle it, if it's not backed up by supportive parents, it can mess up the whole thing. Is that right?
They can trump the effect of it.
They can trump it. And it's not just that there can be a little bit of an impact. They can trump it.
They can trump it. Right. So what does a child need to do when they leave the school? They need to have a place to study. They need to have some place to be reinforced that the preparing for the class is important. And they need to have, if possible, the kind of parental support that says, no, 2 + 2 is not 5, it's 4. And so in some communities where it is present that the parents are willing, perhaps, but not skilled, some of the schools are reaching out beyond the school and they're moving into the community to supply support structures for parents. And so that's not necessary probably universally here in Chapel Hill, but in some of our for some of our students, it is true. Mm. And for some whole communities in certain sections of North Carolina, it is absolutely true.
Well, this is interesting, Charles. I need to take a break, but I want to come back and commit heresy. That is talking about how you respond to these new realities that that you're teaching us. Visiting with Charles Coble, the former Dean of Education at East Carolina University and Vice President of the UNC system. We're talking about schools and teachers and what we need to do to make them better. And I'll be right back.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Charles Coble is my guest. Dr. Coble is now the co-director, science and mathematics teacher imperative. And this is from the Association of Land Grant Universities. What is that? How does all this work?
Yes, the Association of Public and Land Grant Universities. Chapel Hill, North Carolina State University, and a few other universities, including ECU and Greensboro and Charlotte, are member organizations. Virginia, you know, Georgia Tech, Michigan State, the
so
big state universities.
Public universities, right. Land Grant institutions.
Yeah.
Concerned about their responsibility for teacher education.
Right. That's right.
Now, this is new to me.
Right.
What you told me, and that is that the experience in the classroom with great teachers is different for students depending upon the level of supportive parental involvement that they can get. So, what we've done, and I just say this, we liberals. And I'm totally in favor of this, is that we have insisted that our schools are representative of the entire culture,
right.
And that we bring students from all different family backgrounds, racial, ethnic backgrounds together, and that the common democratizing experience that they have is incredibly important for the country, for them. And that somehow will work out what they learn in the classrooms. But if what you tell me is true, that is that they have a whole variety of different parental support networks at home, then you ask a teacher to teach to a group of kids whose parental support is widely different, and you give them a challenge. Wouldn't it be better if the students who came from non-supportive households got the kinds of support that they would have to have from a teacher who's trained to teach them, and those who come from supportive households get the kind of teaching and support that is good for kids from supportive high schools, so that we go back to segregated schools on the basis of race, ethnic background, and economy.
Right.
Now, You've pushed me into heresy, so get me back on board.
All right. Well, I'll try because, I mean, there is – you know, we have unfolding in Wake County an argument along that line. However, that's just one of the variables There are other variables, okay, and they relate to modeling, the experience that these students see and have in a school in which they have different models of academic achievement. The in-school factor of relationships across academic success stories so far, and also not, if you will, placing the bar so high in schools for teachers that the only capacity they have, if you will, is to rely on what they can do with those students external to the community. That is, there are factors that seem to ghettoize schools that lower the expectations over time for both the teachers and the students in a school.
So theoretically, I might be right, but then practically, yeah. You can argue with that. But right. But practically speaking, when you get into that kind of separation and segregation, you run into a whole bunch of consequences that are just terrible.
There are many other variables, and I haven't explained it very well. But lot that goes on when you make a school a monocultural school. However, there are people who argue for that we could serve students better if we put economic class and pass achievement together. But we don't have a history of showing that really
happened. We have some of the – help me with this again. Sure. But I mean, we see these on TV all – once a year there will be an academy in a very deprived neighborhood with an inspirational set of teachers and principals who are spot on in terms of what kind of background these kids come from. And they deliver a learning experience that does not assume parental support, and they're able to either muster a little bit more parental support appropriate to that neighborhood. And they have these high-achieving kids because their whole experience is keyed to those kids, not to a bunch of kids who would expect a high degree of parental involvement.
Right. Well, and I visited some of those schools in New York and even in North Carolina, Gaston Preparatory School.
Right.
In which these hugely poor minority schools are outperforming many of the best schools in North Carolina. However, there are some points of that. Okay. Those students have to actually apply to be in those schools. It's a very rigorous selection process. And actually, parents or guardians or some community support structure has to.
So they insist on having parental support.
They insist on it. Mm-hmm. It's an entry requirement just to be able to be selected into the school in most places. In those places where that requirement is not as rigorous, they take on a huge after-school functionality. That is, when the bell rings at 3, the school is not over. Mm-hmm. And so things start happening to those kids, homework halls, all kinds of structures, even midnight basketball, Jim Johnson's approach over Durham, that all of these structures have been in place to fill that gap of parental and community support. So in the absence of direct parent and community support, the schools supply them. With other kinds of mechanisms.
And which is what is needed to provide success for that kind of student.
It is. You just
if you take that kind of student and throw them into a normal school, which anticipates parental support or just can't deal with it, they drop out.
They do in vast numbers. I mean, there are some schools, and even some in North Carolina, that have the label dropout factories. And so the system will override good intentions every time. And so you have to intervene into the system. But one of the things you have to recognize is that school is a huge part. And I don't mean to imply that we can't make a very big difference in school, in children. And we can. And we got a lot to do there with preparing teachers and having them teach to higher standards and expectations. But it is not over when the school bell rings. There's more going on. And so in some communities, we can count on the extension of the school right on into the home. In some communities, we can't count on that. In fact, we can know it's not happening. And so we can't wash our hands of that. We have to get engaged. And so, it's more complex. But in some ways, it's a lot more interesting.
And are those – you teach teachers to do this? You teach community leaders. You teach principals. You teach school boards. I mean, how do you get this result of?
Well, I want to say yes to all the.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, but I mean, but they've got other things to worry about.
Yes, they absolutely do. And one of the things that I may have shared this with you once before, one of the things that happened years ago, I had former Governor Hunt down to campus down at ECU, and I was bragging about all the wonderful things we were doing. And he was being appropriately impressed, you know, but he grabbed my arm and he said, in a loving way, I'm sure, but I still have the bruise, I think, in which he said, but what are you doing about teaching your students the importance of community and parent involvement? And it stopped me because we were doing nothing. And we were the largest teacher education program in the
state.
Well,
I'll ask you the same question. What are you doing now about that with your clients?
Right.
The nation's
well,
schools.
This is thank you.
Charles. Right. Can you remember that question through the break?
I'll remember.
I'm talking too much and not letting you talk enough, and we've run out of time. So we're going to take a quick break. Charles Copeland, I'll be right back.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Dr. Charles Copeland, former Dean of Education at ECU and Vice President of the UNC system. And I left you with a question. I can't remember what it was.
Well, it was a question about what are we doing now about parental involvement. Well, not enough. I mean, I don't know what every school or university is doing, but I can guarantee you it's not enough. And so this just gets into what am I doing now in the world. And primarily I'm working with institutions, some across the nation, specific institutions, and then some in whole states. Like one of my major pieces of work is down in Georgia. And we're trying to flip the idea of how we prepare teachers from being one of – I will say this is simplistic, and I don't mean to offend my colleagues when I say this, but one from primarily teaching them about how to teach – to, in fact, getting them more involved in the direct interventions into the schools and working with schools that have good parent education programs in place. So it's not just teaching people, oh, you ought to involve the parents, you ought to involve the schools, trying to find clinical settings where those schools recognize how critical that is, and then putting our students into those schools for their student teaching, if you will, or their field placements, observations, and get them involved in deep engagement with parents and community in real time to see how it works.
So, I mean, the bright spot for me in the – I mean, first of all, you're taking me down to despair, and now there's some bright spots. That although parental involvement is quite a challenge, there are some schools that have tackled it.
Oh, yes.
And it can't – we wouldn't argue that they've got perfect outcomes, but that they know some things to do that work.
Absolutely.
And that those are the places where we need to put our teachers who are in training, that are, who are being educated to go into the teaching workforce. They need to have experience there so that it won't be strange. So they'll expect that in
their
schools.
And it's true for a lot of other things as well, seeing good teachers who are teaching, seeing good mentoring going on. I mean, good leadership in the school. You know, you can have a good teacher in any school, but you can't have a good teacher. You can have a whole school
of
good
teachers.
How
do you pick these good schools? How do you find them, and how do you walk down the street and know a good school versus one that's not as good?
Right. Well, you do look at a lot of factors, okay? You do look at what's happening in that school over time. Do the students come in that school, and have they done something about the lower students' performance? And are things moving in the right direction? Do you have the teachers who are reporting engagement? Do you have teachers staying in the school? You know, sometimes you can know what's happening in a school by the number of people who are trying to leave that school. That says a lot about the leadership. So we have a lot of data points along the way, teacher retention.
So you got some objective measures that you can – that would send some schools to the top. Then you would want to spec them out.
Right. Exactly.
Now, you remember our friend Jay Robinson.
Absolutely.
and he would always say, Charles, that this is easy. I mean, he didn't say that really, but he said in looking for the silver bullet for the best school, it is you get a good principal.
Absolutely.
And you will have a good school.
Yep.
I mean, do you believe in that?
I do, strongly. I do strongly. One of the best ways to improve teacher performance is to get a good principal. They will both support, they will look for talent, they'll support the talent, and they'll develop the talent. You know, they'll put teachers in connection with each other.
So whatever you do in training teachers isn't going to work unless you got that principal who's supportive of the—
The high water mark, I think, of teacher preparation is the effectiveness of our clinical settings. So one of the best thing we can do to produce a better teacher is to pick the right schools for the field, clinical and field experiences so they see in practice, they see in reality the good things that they can do.
Then they are assigned to a school that where things are not going as well. Many of us facing that kind of challenge would grumble and start looking for another place. But do you train your teachers to get active and make a difference or to look for another place?
Well, let me back up on one thing because you reminded me of something I need to quickly say, and that is finding the best principals and the best schools doesn't always mean going to what our image may take us to. That is a suburban school where, you know, frankly, all the kids are white and from middle class parents or upper class parents. They got a lot of money and the school's achieving sort of in spite of anything. The better approach is actually finding a school.
Go to the hard places.
Go to the hard place, but where a principal is really moving that school. They may not be there yet, but you know he or she is there on the right path, and you got some measures of that.
So the best schools are in the challenged areas where they're making progress, not the ones that necessarily – and I don't want to say this without respect for Chapel
sure.
Hill, where
Absolutely.
We have great scores and we're proud of it, but it might be –
Yeah,
a lot because while we've got great kids and great families, where you go is you go to a school in a more diverse neighborhood. Say to go to Durham in a challenged neighborhood and find a school that's achieving. Then you know you got something that's really
sellable. I mean, I think one of the challenges of this university's College of Education, School of Education programs is making sure that their prospective teachers have experiences in some of those alternative environments.
Charles, the other thing, if I'm a teacher, I'm a prospective teacher.
Right.
And comparing, and just like if I were a teacher in the university.
Right.
You know, the reason I want to teach is I want to teach good kids who are willing and eager to learn. And that's that's the exciting thing about the profession. And what you're saying is where we really need good teachers is not exactly where the kids have the best preparation to, you know, so on a different kind of teacher.
America's middle class and upper classes are doing reasonably well in the competition nationally. Man, we got a lot more to do, but they're in the game. The soft underbelly of American education is what are we doing for everybody else? And that everybody else is getting to be the majority. And so we have got to take that on. With abandon.
How do we make the teachers who take on those assignments the heroes of this world and the principals the heroes
good
of
point.
This world?
You know, I was in a conference just yesterday in Jekyll Island in which we asked that very question. And our sort of motto, we sort of adopted an Army motto, and that is, this is the toughest job you'll ever love. And so instead of selling the teaching profession with apples and little red schoolhouses, we paint the picture of what needs to be done in this country. And it's a tough job. Now, you want to take it on? You know, and we try to sell that. And I think we have Peace Corps volunteers, VISTA volunteers, we have Teach for America volunteers, some of the brightest kids in this country willing to take on that challenge, and that's what we need.
This reminds me, I mean, I start crying when I think of this, but this is a Teach for America girl. 10 or 15 years ago, my daughter was teaching in New York, and I thought she was having a challenging experience in a junior high school in the South Bronx. Then she introduced me to her roommate, who was a former UNC soccer player. And she'd been assigned – her Teach for America experience was assigned to take on the kids in classrooms that nobody else would take. Ones who are out of jail, who are pregnant, who were She went to school with her aunts and Dorian's attitude. She kicked Fanny, since we're on radio.
Right.
And she was so excited about each one of them and what she could deliver and not going to be brought down because she didn't succeed at every time. 100% into that classroom of really kids who were just lost. And she was she's going to turn them around. You know, I don't know how you recruit, train, and pay that kind of person for those tough challenges.
Well,
but maybe that's what, you know, that's maybe more about what the teaching profession
is
to be like.
I think it's where we are right now. Finding people who are going to take on a tough job that they will love. But not putting them in there in isolation and expecting them to overcome the entire system. We got to send them in there in teams with a platoon and with a good leader, okay, surrounded by a support structure. And we can do it. I loved it. I love it when Jim Hunt ends up ever on his argument. You know, we can do this. Well, we really can do this, and we know how to do that. We got great examples, so now we need to do it. We have the future sort of now, but it's just not widely distributed. You know, we have places doing this all over the country.
Where's the best place? I mean, where is a good place to go see where people understand what needs to be done and are doing it?
Yeah. So I've been to some academies in Harlem, in New York. You said this cannot be happening, but it is happening. I've been into some of the Hispanic boroughs in Austin, Texas, and seeing some of the poorest schools you can imagine, in which the university is saddled up next to those schools, and exciting things are going on. I've been in the middle of Columbus, Ohio, in which they have a problem-centered school, and the kids are from the, quote, worst possible situations in there, and you would want your children to be in those schools. Mm. They're having an exciting time. And we have some cases like that in North Carolina, too. Some of the new schools project that's happening, the new tech high schools right here in the state, over at Hillside, they're doing some great things. So we have some examples both in rural and in urban areas of our state. Mm-hmm. We just need that to become the norm, not the exception.
Well,
so we
Charles
got a good
Cole,
challenge.
Thanks for ending on that upbeat note and for giving us a realistic hope for the improvement of education for our K-12 and for the teachers who
Thank you,
teach
DG.
Them. Our guests have been Dr. Charles Coble, former Dean of the School of Education at East Carolina and Vice President of the UNC System. Thanks to him, and thanks to all y'all for listening. It's been Who's Talking. I'll be back here before you know it.